And our guest tonight, noted author Deborah Blum. We're talking about her book, Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death. We'll continue her discussion in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Deborah, what kind of work did they do trying to check into haunted houses?
They really wanted to figure out why people might see a ghost in a particular place repeatedly. And so one of the things they looked at was this idea that a place or an object can store energy, that there is an energy related to an event, especially a traumatic event, and that it leaves a certain kind of signature. In fact, William James, one of his theories was that, you know, we live these lives full of energy and passion and laughter and all of these things, and that energy doesn't just go away. He called it a cosmic reservoir. So they did a couple of kinds of experiments. One was, they stayed in haunted houses. That one was they really explored that idea that an object can hold energy and that people can read from it. The kind of thing where you might give a medium or a psychic a piece of jewelry from someone and see what they say. And they certainly got a lot of information from that. And then they looked at, you know, why do we see ghosts and why do we see them the way we do? So one of the things that interested me most was what they call the ghosts of clothes problem, which is if you believe that a ghost is a form of energy, why do you see a ghost wearing clothes? Because clothes have no afterlife and have no energy.
Manifestation, I would guess.
Right. And then the other part of it is, let's just say that it's the ghost of, your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this sort of, I'm going to call it a blast of energy or jolt of energy, a manifestation, but it's energy. And you're the receiver. And so when you receive this blast of energy or this connection, it calls your grandmother to mind, and you put the clothes on because you're going to then remember her as she was. And so one of the things they looked at that was so interesting to me and that I think makes this so difficult for science is the whole problem of communication, the communication between a spirit and me, the communication between myself and my husband, right? Equally imperfect in all kinds
right.
of ways.
Yeah.
And so they did a beautiful job of saying, here's what might explain a ghost, and then here's why the ghost might look as it does.
Earlier, I was talking about Thomas Edison, and mm-hmm. We've got a little story about him on our coasttocoastam.com website. I really believe this guy was so far ahead of his time that had he not died in 1931, he might have invented this machine that would have allowed communication with the dead. He may have pulled it off because he believed, as these three believed, that this had to do with energy. And he might have been able to find it. And that would have been incredible, Deborah.
It would have been incredible. And I still think that some of the answers that we're looking for have to do with forms of energy that we just haven't figured out yet. And I mean, it's interesting to me because I was actually talking about this to a physicist in Chicago. I talk about it to everyone now. So, and I said to him, you know, it's got to be some kind of energy that we haven't figured out how to measure yet. I know we look at magnetic fields and we look at electricity, but there's got to be something that we just don't know yet. He said to me, well, you know, basically, duh, of course, if you look at cosmology, everyone's talking about dark energy right now, which is the name for energy that we know is out in the universe that we don't know what it is. And there's no reason in the world why we can't say this is just an energy that we haven't figured out yet.
Well, I got to tell you, it is fascinating. Somebody somewhere, I think, will develop some kind of machine to allow it. I think what's going to probably happen one day is some computer will be the mechanism to communicate with the other side.
That could be.
Yeah. I mean, they might be able to move the mouse, you know, telepathically. Who knows?
Wouldn't that be interesting?
I mean, it's being done now with people who are quadriplegics, and they put little chips in their brain, and they're able to do that.
Or if you even did something on the nature of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, where you're just scanning for energy wavelengths, right? I really wish. I mean, it's actually become something that I've thought about a lot recently, that we could persuade what I'm calling mainstream science to take another look at this. I think there's so much potential there if you could get a really organized effort to look.
Did they ever talk about being afraid of their research? You know, did they ever come across spirits that were, you know, not very friendly?
You know, James spent some time looking at what I'm going to call possession. And there was a wonderful case. It was called the Waseca Wonder at the time, very Victorian, in which a girl was apparently possessed by the spirit of a girl very close to her age. This was in Iowa. And suddenly lost all memory of who she was and went to the house where the dead girl had lived and remembered everything about it. I don't know if you'd call that unfriendly, but I don't think it was anything she was asking to happen to her. And there were occasionally just things that happened that freaked them out. There was a story I actually told in the book of a girl who disappears one day. She's walking down toward a lake. It's in New Hampshire, and she never comes back, and they go out. They're looking for her. No one can find her. There's a woman in another town who actually dreams the death and is able to help them find the body, which is trapped in the bridge. And the diver who goes down, they've called in a professional diver, and he can't find it till this woman tells them where to look. They ask him later, they go, weren't you afraid down there in the water when it's dark, knowing there's a dead body?
Yeah, that could come right up to your face.
And he said, no, I was afraid of the woman on the bridge. And so occasionally they just bump into something. It almost shakes the foundations of how you see the world, and you see that in their writing.
I mean, would you, if let's assume, you know, tonight after the show, you're ready to go to bed, and all of a sudden you look in the mirror and you see a ghost looking back at you, you know, behind you or something. Would you be petrified?
It would definitely be an unnerving experience, right?
Yeah.
I think I'd turn around, so I would like to see it a little better. Yeah. I mean, in the few times that I've been doing this and I've had that incredible sense of reality that I know you can have, it really shakes you up. I mean, even just being in a telepathy experiment and getting an image that was right, that I hadn't expected to get, I had to go out and have a drink.
Did they write position papers of their work and research that they published?
They did. I mean, and they fought. I admire them. They fought so hard. I mean, they got their work into mainstream journals. Some of them, one of the chemists involved edited his own chemistry journal in England, and he published the work. And then they published the Journal of, you know, Psychical Research, and they published a lot in that. They wrote books. They wrote, what was really interesting, is they also wrote in popular magazines. So you'd see William James and Scribner, say, or Richard Hodgson in Harper's, and they really took their work out there. They wrote for the New York Times, actually. It's amazing. That's the other thing I think that's amazing to me as a journalist, is that you see, you know, front page of the New York Times talking about this work in a way that I think would be so difficult to do today.
Did they devote their entire careers totally to this research, or were they still doing other things too?
Richard Hodgson and James Hislop pretty much devoted their careers and their lives to this research.
I mean, how'd they live? How'd they make any money doing that?
They were subsidized by other members of the association to some extent. James paid Hodgson's salary sometimes. So did some of these guys in England.
Did they have big grant money?
What's that?
Did they have grant money? I mean, did they have the Bill Gates of the world out there at the time?
Don't you wish? They did have some people who were very interested who donated to their societies. And they had dues. You know, they were societies that had dues-paying members. But, I mean, if you look at someone like Richard Hodgson, in the years that he was working in Boston and all he was doing was trying to make people understand what he was doing and listen to it, he lived very poor, you know. He was, like, living on tea and eggs a lot of the time. And he just cared about it so much that he was willing to do that.
Let's talk a little bit about the medium Leonora Piper. We touched on her just very briefly. Let's go back a little bit. Did James discover her, or how did this all happen again?
You know, I really found her fascinating. She was not a professional medium. She was a Boston area housewife. And James did at least make her famous. Other people had heard of her. His mother-in-law went to see her, and then she persuaded him to go take a look. And he went under an assumed name, you know, which was the standard of the time.
And she was doing this, what, privately?
Yes.
Okay.
He went to her house, and she was able to give him information, right down to the name eventually, of a son of his who had died earlier. And he kept going back. They studied her, and I was talking earlier about the trance test. But they took her to England and put her in a house where she didn't know anyone and asked her questions. They studied her in all kinds of situations, and she was phenomenal. I mean, she was really an amazing medium. You read some of the things that she told people, and you just think to yourself, there's no way in the world that she could have known that. And Richard Hodgson had her followed by detectives at one point. He was so convinced that she was somehow secretly getting information, so he had her spied on for weeks. And she wasn't, you know. They didn't find anything.
Did they end up believing her?
Yes. I mean, it was interesting. James said that she was the most... He began by saying that... And I've always liked this. If you want to prove that all crows are not black, you need only find one white crow. And
true.
Leonora Piper is my white crow. And he ended by saying, it's so baffling working with a medium, is what he said. You know, sometimes they're so on, and sometimes it's as if they just can't hear whatever the signal is. And so James probably ended up a little more frustrated than Richard Hodgson, who completely believed that she had proved the existence of a spirit world. And he, you know, he worked with her in bringing back spirits of people he knew. He worked with her in setting up experiments in which she knew nothing and still gave information. I don't want to, like, go on forever, but I could tell you one good Leonora Piper story.
I'd love to. As a matter of fact, I was going to ask you to. And then also, what happened to her, you know, after, you know, these three faded away, or did they ever fade away from her?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, one of my favorite Leonora Piper stories was actually, it's in a private letter to James. James was at Harvard, and one of his fellow psychologists or scientists got so interested in these reports that he wrote to Richard Hodgson under an assumed name and made an appointment to come see her. And he said he sat down, and she talked for 45 minutes telling him things that were so private that he wasn't even going to tell William James. But he had brought with him a ring. He had exchanged rings with his mother about a decade earlier, and each of them had written a special word in a favorite word, essentially, in the ring that they gave to each other. And he had lost the ring that his mother had given him. But when she had died a few years earlier, he had gotten the ring that he gave her. And he brought that ring with him to see Leonora Piper. And he held it in his hand and he said, "Tell me the word that's in Mother's ring." And she immediately told him the word that was in the lost ring.
Now, was she remote viewing? Do you know what that is, by the way? Have you studied that?
No, she just knew things she shouldn't have known.
All right, was she told by a spirit? I mean, that's what I want to know. How did she get the information? Some people remote view, Deborah. Some people have the ability to send their minds and their thoughts out to different locations. A lot of psychics have an ability to do that. They work with police departments.
Right.
Others are true mediums, you know, that they get information from the dead, basically. Is that what she did?
You know, some people said yes, and some people said they didn't think of it so much as remote viewing, but a form of sort of extended telepathy. So you found these guys arguing and passionately. Richard Hodgson saying, "Look, she just talks to the dead because she's actually been able to say things not known by people in the room." And then you would have someone like William James say, "Is she talking to the dead, or is she just an amazing telepath, right, that the man holding the ring thinks of the word in the other ring?"
And she's picking it. That's right. She's picking it right out of him. Okay.
And they didn't know. What they did know was that there was no way to spend any time with her and not believe that she had what James called supernormal abilities. There was no way. And you read about her. And I wish I could spend hours talking about some of the amazing things that she did. And you just think, there is no way this woman could have done this and not have an ability that I don't have.
That is amazing.
She was amazing, truly amazing.
Are there good mediums out there now that you know of?
We've heard
the names of Van Praags and people like that. Do you think that they're pretty good?
I think that anyone who achieves sort of a national prominence does it because they have been able to know things that they couldn't have known. I actually happen to think a lot of James Van Praagh.
I do too.
And I've been talking to different people about mediums that are far less famous. Actually, a couple here in Madison where I live, and who are also, you know, who are not, you know, who do sittings for free or who do sittings only by word of mouth. You know, they're not really trying to be famous. They just have an ability they want to use. I think that there's more people out there like that than a lot of people are aware. Not perfectly studied all the time, but I think they're there.
Well, that's a strong possibility. I wonder, and did James ever wonder how they got this gift?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And these guys spend a lot of time sort of looking at, I actually would love to do a story about this, and I actually have written to James Van Praagh asking him if I could interview him for it, on the mind, the psychology of a medium or a psychic. In the case of Leonora Piper, she just started almost as a child hearing things or telling people things she shouldn't have known. I think that some people just happens to them. James had a really interesting theory about it in which he argued that there is this kind of energy information out there and that most of us are very well buffered against that, and it keeps us functional, right? It would be like being an uncontrolled radio receiver if you didn't have some natural buffers. And his suspicion was that people who are born mediums or psychics were less well defended, naturally less well defended. It was easier for them to pick up these kind of signals than for most people, and that for most people, it took, you know, an extraordinary amount of energy. Say, again, a crisis apparition when someone that you knew and loved dies, and you get almost a blast of energy that goes through your defenses. They had some evidence that, you know, you could, that an injury in particular or ill health could create a medium, that it lowered defenses. And certainly that was true for Leonora.
Let's talk a little bit about spirituality when we come back, Deborah. I want to see if these three, these noted practitioners, had any spirituality, to see if that affected their thought. We'll be back in a moment. And we're going to take your phone calls next hour with our special guest, Deborah Blum. In a moment, I'll be right back with her on Coast to Coast AM. Deborah, by the way, William James, did he write a ghost novel back at the turn of the century, do you know?
He didn't, but his brother did. His brother Henry wrote Turn of the Screw.
Ah.
And wrote a few really cool little ghost stories. One of my favorites called The Romance of Old Clothes, and it's got a woman who marries her sister's husband and then is killed by her dead sister's husband, and then is actually killed by her dead sister's ghost. It's a very lovely, creepy story.
Now, did any of the three gentlemen that we're talking about tonight, did they, you know, were they very religious? Were they very spiritual? What were they?
I mean, all of them were religious in the sense that they believed in some kind of a god. I'm not sure all of them accepted the teachings of Christianity. And I think part of that for them was that if you look at the period that I'm writing about, the church was dead set against many of the advances of science, and these gentlemen were scientists. And the church was very hostile to spiritual research. These guys thought that if they could prove the existence of supernatural powers, that was one step closer to God. It was evidence for supernatural powers and a greater being. But you got this very hostile reaction from a lot of the sort of Orthodox clergy saying, no, the afterlife you're talking about is not the one described in our Bible, and therefore, you know, you're working against us. It was very much of a concern to the church at the time, because the church of spiritualism at the time was the fastest growing religion. So I think there was actually some turf war going on.
Well, were they very vocal in the work they were doing, or, you know, was it like in a secret laboratory and, you know, nobody really knew what was going on at the time?
I thought they were pretty vocal. I mean, they tended to say, do a lot of experiments and wait till they really had what they called, you know, something compelling before they took it published. James was always saying, you know, the bigger bomb we can explode, the more people are going to listen to us. So some of the stuff they would wait until they built it up into something that looked good. I mean, if you looked at Hodgson's work with Leonora Piper, he spent, boy, 6-7 years studying her before he issued his first report. I mean, he wanted every, because they knew what they were doing was so controversial.
Whatever happened to her after they walked away and did whatever they were going to do?
Well, you know, it's one of the things I've actually asked myself this. Hodgson died very unexpectedly of a heart attack in 1905, and Hyslop then took over the American Society for Psychical Research and continued till early 1920s, and then James died in 1910, and there was this period, this is going to sound a little wonky maybe, but there's a period where as these guys' work gets better and better, they just start disappearing one after another, like a row of dominoes. There was one point when I was reading and I was going, you know, is there some reason why this is just being cut off? But most of them, long before Edison started working on his wonderful machine, most of the people I was writing about were gone.
What happened to them?
Yeah, they died of serious What various natural causes, really. None of them lived to be incredibly old, including William James. So he had a long-standing heart condition. You know, one of the more interesting ones was a guy in England named Fred Myers, who was part of the British group, and he had a long-lost lover that he had begun to communicate with, and the medium he was working with brought him a message from his dead lover saying that he would be with her within a year, and or somewhere around the turn of the 20th century. And within 2 years, he was dead. And it was interesting because James was one of the people who was there when he died, and he said the disease took no known path. He was trying to figure out how much that prophecy had influenced what happened.
Were they convinced, when it was all done, that there was definitely something after a death, or did they say possibly? Big difference.
Yes, there is a big difference. Yes, all of them, to some extent, believed that there was something after death. The question was, what was it? You know, was it like an energy imprint, an echo almost of what we were, or was it actually spirit life? And if I look at my group, by the end of it, the majority of them believed in spirit life. I mean, part of it was some of those experiments they were doing at the end, their cross correspondence, their work with mediums, the evidence they'd built up for energetic communication. Most of them believed in some kind of spirit life. And those that didn't at least believed in the possibility of some kind of energy information system that we haven't figured out yet. And even the year before his death, James, who, you know, was one of the most cautious, was saying, someday when science is willing to take this on, though this is going to be the most important work that science does, they're going to answer this question.
I don't know if you've ever heard some of our electronic voice phenomena on the program before, Deborah, but a couple groups have gone out and they've done recordings, and then they played the sound back for us. It's pretty eerie.
You know, I haven't heard it. I've been reading about EVP in a couple of books that are, you know, obviously are more focused on now than then. Sounds fascinating.
I'm going to be doing a remote in November on the QE2, which is docked here at Long Beach. And this thing is haunted. This whole ship is haunted. I mean, it used to cart around war soldiers and things like that, and I'm looking forward to it. And they're going to put me right splat in some haunted section when I'm going to be on the air. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Oh, I'll have to listen to that.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating.
We'll let you know. It's second week, I think, in November.
I think I'll stay up for that.
You got to stay up for all these programs
all of these
now
programs.
That you've been on. Of the three, was it William James who really steered the direction of their research?
You know, William James was yes, in some ways. I think Hodgson was the most passionate and dedicated, and then Hislop in terms of doing it full time. But because James had so much stature, and because he was willing to put it on the line, what he was able to do was elevate them to a point that people listened to what they said. And you do see this absolute fury in the Orthodox scientific community about William James doing this. He gets, like, these furious letters, you know, about the fact that he is using his reputation to make people take this work seriously. And he blows it off. He was incredibly tough and incredibly determined. So you really see him using his prestige as a platform to say, look, this matters, and it matters to me, and you need to listen.
You know, I wonder when each one of them was on their deathbed, I wonder what they were thinking. I wonder if they thought, all our research over the years, I wonder if it really is real now. I wonder if there's a moment of doubt that comes into everybody's mind when they're ready to die.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, either you're totally sure, but most of us, because we're so, because so much of it is a mystery, and it's such a fascinating puzzle. Unless you really believe that you've solved that puzzle in its entirety, you're bound to have some kind of little twinge of doubt. I think, and you see with some of these guys, and I heard this particularly with Richard Hodgson, that he was so sure. He was so sure that he knew. And there's even the moment, I think I told the story somewhere in the book, where he's standing talking to a friend and saying he almost can't wait till he dies. He knows that he'll have all the answers when he's on the other side. So a few of these guys, what their research actually achieved was kind of an amazingly pure confidence.
I want to bring a microphone with me. That's what I want to do, and I want to broadcast from the other side.
Okay, I'm going to count on you doing that.
That'll be a first. We'll set up a code, though, just so you'll know it's me.
Okay.
Because I may not sound the same.
Well, just tell me, okay?
You know, of everything that you've uncovered as a scientific journalist,
okay,
how would you categorize this topic with everything else? And then tell us some of the things you've done. What other, not necessarily books, but what other assignments have you had? I want to compare them to this.
Well, let me just start at that end of it, because I've been a mainstream science writer for a long time. So I've covered a lot of the obvious things. I was a newspaper reporter in California, Northern California, for a lot of years. So, of course, I did seismology, climate. Mm-hmm. I wrote about the Strategic Defense Initiative in the Reagan years, did a lot of X-ray laser nuclear bomb design.
You've
stuff.
Done it all.
Primate research, which was what I won the Pulitzer for. Biology of sex differences. That was a book, Sex on the Brain. Child development I've looked at. Yeah, I mean, I've sort of written, like all newspaper science writers do, and that was how I started, across the sciences. And I started out as a chemistry major. My dad's a biologist. I really grew up in science.
Okay, so as someone who has looked at a lot of facets of science, and then this, how would you categorize what you've learned?
You know, it's been interesting to me. I think this, the questions in this are more interesting to me in some ways, because I think that there are questions about, and you really said this probably more eloquently earlier, but there are questions about both who we are and who we are in this larger universe that we live in. And so you can understand exactly why someone like William Jones would say these were, the most important things science could address. I've found it most fascinating in the fact that I think science does, if you can wade through all the hostilities and get through to the good work that's actually there, the magic 5% almost, it does say to you, yeah, there's a natural history here. There's something real here. We just haven't figured it out yet. So I still think of it as science. I don't feel that I've suddenly, left my home ground of being a science journalist. What I think I'm doing is sort of expanding it.
What did they say, if anything, about hell, about demons, about the other side? Because I believe that exists in some form or fashion as well.
That's a good question. And I don't know that they looked so much at demons and hell, except for James. And James did actually wrote a chapter and a whole essay once on demon possession. And they looked at that, but it wasn't really one of their major focuses.
You remember the movie Ghost? With Whoopi Goldberg.
And, I love that movie.
Oh, I do too.
Movie.
Demi Moore was in that.
And Patrick Swayze.
Patrick Swayze.
Yes.
And I keep thinking of the scenes where the two bad people in the movie, the guy who paid the person to kill him and then the actual killer, when they died, you remember those ugly, horrible, black, shadowy things that
those
grabbed them?
Those creepy black things that took them away.
With that horrible sound.
Yes.
You know what? That probably isn't too far-fetched, Because with good, there's evil. I think this universe balances itself out. And somewhere along the line, it's too bad that these three didn't check into that. But I'm convinced that there's as much evil out there is good in terms of this balance.
Right.
And I think there are some demonic areas on the other side. Maybe plateaus, levels that you go through, that they're there. I would love to see research in that area as well, Deborah. Almost like, is there a devil?
I think that would be a fascinating subject. And although my guys did not really explore it, they did look a lot at what they called the moral universe, right? As you get in a lot of science, the mechanical universe, right? And they did argue that there had to be some kind of system out there that kept morality in balance. I think they've probably fumbled with this actually more than you do.
I like that analogy. And I think it would work.
Yeah, I do too, actually.
What do you do next? What's your next assignment?
Well, for now, I actually would like to try to write a little bit more on this issue. I'd like to use some of my science writing contacts to try to explore this issue in some other interesting ways. I really would like to do a magazine article on the science of the psychology of mediums and psychics. I think that would be a great thing to do. So at the moment, all I'm doing is writing magazine pieces. I actually just finished a piece for the National Association of Science Writers on all the ghost stories that people have told me and how they've influenced the way I think.
You said earlier that you didn't possess any of these abilities.
No.
Has this topic, in the fact that you did some work in it and researched it, has it sensitized you at all, though? Because I'm convinced everybody can be taught this. Everybody can be trained. I'm just wondering if the more exposure you get to it, the more enlightened you become, and then you change. You begin to pick up things.
Well, that's a good question. I think that's possible, partly because I just think, the more you're willing to sort of open yourself up, speaking of barriers, I think you can, really barricade yourself in. The one thing that I did that I hadn't done before was do this very controlled telepathy experiment at the ASPR, American Society for Psychical Research. Despite the fact that I had been announcing to people for decades that I had absolutely no ability in this, they had someone on another floor transmitting an image, and I actually got this image, and it really freaked me out. So my next plan is to go see a local medium who I understand is quite excellent and just keep exploring a little bit more.
Do you ever run across any mediums that may be from the Los Angeles area? Is there anybody out here you would like to recommend that we could do a live seance with?
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
I haven't heard, and this, I'm sort of focused more to the East Coast. I know there's a great medium, actually, I believe it's in Alexandria, who some of my science writing friends go to and swear by. But I'm less sort of savvy about LA medium.
Did the three, as you call your guys,
my guys,
did they ever investigate exorcisms? We talked a little bit about evil, but what about that area?
Actually, they did. They investigated exorcisms. They did investigate some possessions. They worked with some clergymen, actually, in dealing with some of these problems. And they also spent some time looking at people who practiced mind control, I think. So, they sort of danced around the fringes of it, but they were more or less, and they looked at poltergeists. They did some serious investigations of poltergeists. But they were really trying to focus on, maybe to some extent to their detriment, building up a case that they could use to sway the scientific community. So they tended to focus a lot on issues that they thought that they could make a really persuasive case for.
You've got to dig up an old book called Breakthrough to Creativity by my late aunt, Shafika Karagula, K-A-R-A-G-U-L-L-A.
Okay.
Take a look at that if you can find it, probably on Amazon.com. It'll open your mind up even more, Deborah, to this topic, and might even spur you to go in another direction as well.
Definitely look that up.
Stay with us. We're going to have phone calls next, questions for Deborah Blum, or you might want to give us one of your stories, because then I'm going to ask Deborah, as a scientific author, if she thinks it's true or not. We'll be back.